All right, so the question we have before us is, was there an ice age? And it's not just that question. When you hear secular scientists talk about an ice age, they don't just talk about one ice age, they talk about many ice ages. Were there many ice ages? Don't secular scientists understand the cause of ice ages? And if they do, isn't that kind of an argument for an old Earth? What about the woolly mammoths? And what about this claim that these deep ice cores from Greenland and Antarctica prove an old Earth? Now, that's what some people will claim. There was an ice age. There's strong geological evidence for that. And just to be clear, when we talk about an ice age, we're not saying that the entire planet was frozen. Today, about 10% of Earth's land surface is covered by ice, and we think that during the ice age, it was about 30%. So there was more ice, and that was an ice age, but it wasn't like the entire Earth was frozen. So just keep that in the back of your mind when we're talking about this subject. Now, when you hear evolutionists talk about an ice age, they routinely talk about hundreds of thousands of years, millions of years. And again, this raises the question, is the Bible wrong about history? No, the Bible's not wrong about history, and we're going to see that the Bible helps us make sense of an ice age. There's strong geological evidence for an ice age. If you look, when glaciers melt back, they leave behind certain geological features, things that you call moraines, erratic boulders that are sometimes left way out in the middle of nowhere. Sometimes you have scratches in rocks, because when glaciers advance, you know, they have rocks embedded in the ice, and as the glacier advances, it can cause scratches in the ice, in the ground. So there's strong evidence for an ice age because we see these features at lower latitudes where today there is no ice. And so that's a strong indication that the ice sheets once went down to lower latitudes and elevations. But what I'm going to suggest this morning is that the conclusions of millions of years are not demanded by the data. And those conclusions are coming from this uniformitarian philosophy that we mentioned earlier. Again, uniformitarianism is summarized by the motto that the present is the key to the past. And so an evolutionary uniformitarian geologist would say, since erosion occurs slowly today, it's always been slow. And he would argue the Grand Canyon was formed slowly over millions of years. He would argue that the planets, he would argue that they've been orbiting the sun for billions of years. They've been doing their thing for billions of years, like clockwork. They don't allow for the possibility that God created the solar system fairly recently. Today, seafloor sediments are accumulating slowly on the ocean floor. And if you look at the thicknesses of those sediments, if you assume that's always been the case, I mean, you have to have millions of years of deposition. But we would argue that the sediments, many of them were deposited rapidly. Snow and ice today is accumulating fairly slowly, especially in Antarctica, central Antarctica. So if you're a uniformitarian, you're going to assume it's always been doing that. And for the uniformitarian, special creation and the Genesis flood are not on the table for discussion. And the Apostle Peter told us that there would come scoffers in the last day holding to a uniformitarian philosophy. For Peter wrote, knowing this verse, that scoffers will come in the last days, walking according to their own lust, and saying, where is the promise of his coming? For since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning of creation. So that's a very good description of a uniformitarian philosophy. But the belief in millions of years is holding back uniformitarian scientists. And as Christians, we can make better sense of the data. And I want to show you some examples during this talk how their belief in millions of years is actually tripping them up and preventing them from seeing fairly simple explanations for solving some mysteries about Earth history. So we want to make sense of the ice age this morning, and the first point I want to make is that the uniformitarian explanations for an ice age don't work. And they've come up with dozens of theories over the years. I think now the number is over 100. U.S. News and World Report back in 1997 said this is one of the great mysteries of science, and it's still a mystery. One of the problems that they have for explaining an ice age is you might naively think that all you need for an ice age is colder temperatures, right? Turns out it's not that simple, because cold air has less moisture in it. And so if it's really cold, you actually end up with less snow. Not more snow, less snow. And this is one of the things that makes it really hard for secular scientists to explain an ice age. Now, they have dozens of theories. The one that's popular right now, the one that you hear all the talk about, is called the Milankovitch or astronomical theory. The name Milankovitch is the name of a Serbian scientist who did a lot of work in this area. And it's called the astronomical theory because it involves Earth's astronomical motions. And basically, if you assume that the solar system is billions of years old and you can run the clock backwards, over tens of thousands of years, there's going to be subtle changes in the shape of the Earth's orbit. There will be some times where it's a little more circular and sometimes when it's a little less circular. The tilt of the Earth's axis will change, and also the direction in which it's pointing will change. And so the thinking is that over tens of thousands of years, this causes the way the sunlight is falling on the Earth to vary with season and latitude. So the thinking is there would be times in the prehistoric past where less summer sunlight would fall on those high latitude ice sheets, and that would enable the ice sheets not to melt as much, and so the ice grows and you get an ice age. And at other times in the prehistoric past, there would be more summer sunlight falling on those high northern ice sheets. The ice sheets melt back. You get a warm period that they call an interglacial. That's basically the Milankovitch or astronomical theory in a nutshell. And you've probably heard about this theory, even if you didn't hear it called by that name, because you see this on all these popular science TV shows. Now, there's lots of problems with this Milankovitch theory. It really shouldn't be called a theory. It really ought to be a hypothesis. But one of the problems is that these changes in sunlight are very small, and it's really hard to see how those by themselves could be the sole cause of an ice age. And so those who hold to this theory believe there's something that can amplify these small changes so that you can get really significant climate change. And as it turns out, this is actually leading to concerns about the idea that our climate is unstable. People who are worried about global warming or climate change, they are convinced that their climate's unstable. And one of the reasons for that is because of this Milankovitch theory. Because the Milankovitch theory really doesn't work unless the climate's unstable. Because you have to have this small input, this small change in solar radiation has to somehow be greatly amplified so that you can have a transition to a totally different climate state. And so if you believe that, you really have to believe the climate's unstable. So the changes in sunlight are really small. There's many mysteries and paradoxes about this theory. If you look up a textbook on paleoclimates or the study of ancient climates, they list probably six or seven things about this theory that just don't make sense, that involve the timing of the ice ages. One of these problems is that they would claim that within the last million years or so, ice age cycles, and that's really a typo, it shouldn't be ice ages, it should be ice age cycles, were about 100,000 years long. They think that you would have an ice age that lasted maybe 80,000 years and a warm period that would last 20,000 years. Now, it turns out there is a 100,000-year cycle. The problem is the changes in sunlight due to that cycle are the smallest. Okay, these are small changes in sunlight to begin with. These are the smallest of the small. So why would that cause ice ages? Furthermore, there's a famous argument for this theory that really is no longer valid. The reason most secular scientists believe this theory is because of a paper that was published in the journal Science in 1976 called The Pacemaker of the Ice Ages. And what secular scientists were doing back in the 60s and 70s, they were taking these ships out and drilling the sediment cores from the ocean floor. You know, they would pull them up, and you can make chemical measurements in those cores. And they thought that the chemical measurements, if you plot them on a graph as a function of depth, you see all these wiggly patterns. And they thought that those wiggly patterns were telling a story about climate change that agreed very well with this Milankovitch theory. Now, it turns out if you read the fine print of their analysis, there was an assumed age of 700,000 years that played a key role in this pacemaker paper. They could not have gotten statistically significant results without this age assignment of 700,000 years. It was actually the most recent flip of the Earth's magnetic field. Now, we creationists think those magnetic reversals, as I said earlier, were triggered by the Genesis flood. But they claimed back in 1976 that the most recent flip of the Earth's magnetic field was 700,000 years ago. The problem with this is that over 25 years ago, they changed that age assignment to 780,000 years. And they never bothered to check how that would affect the original results. Or if they did, they never published those results. So, and the fact is, it messes those results up. So what I want to show you here is a little chart here, and we're not going to get too technical, but this is called a power spectrum. And you've got frequencies down here, and then you got these spikes, these peaks, and the vertical lines that you see on the graph, those indicate the frequencies that are coming from the astronomical theory. So you've got these cycles, these astronomical cycles, that have those particular frequencies. Those are cycles in thousands of years. The peaks represent the frequencies coming from the analysis of the seafloor sediment data. And what you see, you know, they believe that those chemical wiggles are a climate indicator. They're telling a story about climate change. And in this chart, you see that they're lining up pretty good. Okay, there's pretty good agreement between the astronomical numbers and the numbers coming from the seafloor sediments. And so they thought that's a strong argument for this theory. However, there's actually some problems with that first peak. We don't have time to get into them right now, although we can in the Q&A if you want to later. But that first peak is kind of iffy to begin with. But look what happens when you change that age to 780,000 years. Two of those peaks are no longer lining up, and the one that is still lining up is iffy to begin with. So what happens is they've essentially shot themselves in the foot. They've invalidated their own argument. And I've uncovered some evidence that possibly secular scientists became aware of this around 1996, and they started to panic because someone published a paper in 1997 that, if you read the fine print, it looks like it's an attempt to prop up this pacemaker paper so that the results, you can still say the results are valid. I don't consider that to be very convincing. And I talk about this in that booklet, The Climate Change Conflict, and why I don't think this is really a convincing argument. But if you'd like to learn more about this, you can read plenty of our articles at icr.org. Milankovitch Meltdown, I thought that title up myself. I was kind of proud of it. But if you'd like to learn about this, we've got these articles. And those articles contain active links back to the technical papers that I did on this. So if you want the technical detail, you can get it. But if you want just the lay-level stuff, you can also get it at icr.org. So you've got these big problems with this theory. The changes in sunlight are really small to begin with. It's hard to see how that could be causing ice ages. There's stuff about the theory that just doesn't make sense. And this iconic argument for the theory is in serious question. So that's the first problem, that the uniformitarian explanations don't work. And as I said before, the Milankovitch theory is leading to climate change alarmism, and here's why. The secular scientists know, and I'm putting that in air quotes, that the Milankovitch theory is correct. Most of them have no clue of the problem with that paper that I just told you about. They think it's correct. They think the theory is correct, but they also know that those changes in sunlight are too small to really be the sole cause of an ice age. So they've convinced themselves that something has to be amplifying the climate effect, and therefore our climate's unstable. So if you'd like to read more about this, we have it in the booklet, The Climate Change Conflict. And there's some really interesting stuff about this that I can't tell you right now. We just don't have time, but we talk about it in that little booklet. So the uniformitarian explanations don't work. And second, there was only one ice age, and it happened recently. Secular scientists claim that there were 50 ice ages in the last 2.6 million years. Now, this is not based on geological evidence. There's really only strong geological evidence for one ice age. That claim is actually coming from these chemical wiggles in deep sea sediment cores. You see, once they convinced themselves that the Milankovitch theory was correct, they started using the Milankovitch theory to assign ages to chemical wiggles in other sediment cores. And they call this orbital tuning. And so they actually, what they did was they took data from 57 different sediment cores and they stuck them together to make this big composite data set. And they used orbital tuning to assign ages to it. And you see here, here's 2.6 million years. Guess how many wiggly cycles you have here in that 2.6 million years? About 50. That's why they say there were 50 ice ages in the last 2.6 million years. It's not coming from a careful analysis of the glacial deposits on land. It can't be, because even if you believe multiple ice ages had occurred, the subsequent ice ages, the glaciers and the subsequent ice ages, would bulldoze and destroy the geological evidence for the other ice ages. So this is coming from the Milankovitch theory, and I've said earlier, the Milankovitch theory's got serious problems. Furthermore, the glacial features show evidence of little erosion, which is consistent. Even the evolutionists would agree that the most recent ice age was relatively recent. We think it was more recent than they think, but that was fairly recently. It wasn't millions of years ago. Even by secular reckoning, it would have only been thousands of years ago. So we're arguing there's really only strong geological evidence for one ice age, and our best estimate is that it lasted 700 years. By the way, the secular scientists also claim that there were ancient ice ages hundreds of millions of years ago. The reason for that is that sometimes you will see scratches in rocks that are at locations they think were close to the equator hundreds of millions of years ago. And so they think, okay, that's because the glaciers were coming and you had the rocks embedded in the ice and those rocks carved out those striations. Well, we actually think there's a better explanation for that. We think those are actually caused by giant underwater landslides. And so that's not evidence for past ice ages at all. So there was only one ice age. It happened recently, and the Bible explains this ice age. Now, you might ask, well, what do you need for an ice age? Okay, we've already pointed out these problems with the secular theory. What do you need to get an ice age? Basically, if I had to give you a one-sentence requirement, you need snow and ice not to melt for many consecutive summers. And the reason for that is because you want the snow and ice to start piling up. So if you have snow and ice from one winter, and let's say the next summer, most of that snow and ice doesn't melt, the next winter you get more snow and ice. If that most of that doesn't melt the following summer, the next winter you still get more snow and ice, eventually you're going to start getting these thick ice sheets. And so the bottom line is that you need snow not to melt for many consecutive summers in order to get an ice age. That requires two things. It requires cooler summers. That kind of makes sense, right? You want to keep the snow and ice from melting during the summer, but you also need heavy snowfall. And the reason you need heavy snowfall is that even if you have a cooler summer, the sunshine can still melt a light snowfall. So you got to have cooler summers and you got to have heavy snowfall. Well, Mike Ord is a former meteorologist for the National Weather Service, and he's come up with a model for the ice age that just really blows the doors off anything that the secular scientists have. We call him Mr. Ice Age, and I'm going to try to summarize his model here with the acrostic heat. Maybe this will help you remember it, but the H stands for hot oceans. And we think there was, if you could somehow significantly warm the oceans, that would help trigger an ice age. But you would have to warm it up a lot. And the question is, how does that work? And so we think there was a lot of volcanic activity that was going on. And I want to show you a video clip where Dr. Larry Vardaman, and he's an atmospheric scientist who's also done a lot of research on the ice age, and he explains how heat is really the key that you need to trigger an ice age.
When the heat came up from the plates in the oceans, it caused the oceans to become very warm, and it would be like a giant El Nino effect. Well, can you imagine if the oceans were 20, 30, 40 degrees warmer than they are today? We would expect all kinds of severe weather, gigantic hurricanes, which I call hypercanes, and this would produce all kinds of evaporation into the atmosphere, which could then come out as snow in the polar regions and on mountaintops. I've modeled that with conventional models with a sea surface temperature hotter than we would normally experience today. When that happens, these models predict much, much greater precipitation rates, particularly in the polar regions and on mountaintops. And we can explain the ice age in less than 500 years simply by the warmth of the ocean.
Okay, so that H stands for hot oceans. If you could somehow significantly warm the oceans, that's going to give you more evaporation. That's what the E stands for. And that's going to give you more snowfall. You're going to get more precipitation in general. You're going to get more rainfall at lower latitudes and elevations, but you're also going to get snowfall at higher latitudes and elevations. But you got to still keep that snow and ice from melting, and that's where the A comes in. A stands for aerosols. Now, aerosols are tiny particles or droplets, and when you have big, explosive volcanic eruptions, especially eruptions that have a lot of sulfur in them, you get these sulfuric acid droplets that end up in the stratosphere, and they reflect sunlight, and they give you cooler summers. Based on observations, we know that you get a cooling effect during the summer when this happens. It doesn't really change the winter temperatures much, but it does change the temperatures in the summer. They get cooler. So the Mount Pinatubo eruption, you actually could see some of these volcanic aerosols from the space shuttle. Okay, they're way up in the stratosphere. Now, you may be thinking to yourself, well, that sounds fairly straightforward, right? I mean, if that doesn't sound too complicated. So if there was an ice age, and we know of conditions that could cause an ice age, why is this such a mystery to secular scientists? Well, the reason is that the necessary conditions are anything but uniform. They violate their assumptions of uniformitarianism. Heating of the oceans, well, that would take an outrageous amount of energy. How do you raise the temperature of the oceans 10 or 20 degrees Celsius? You need something, just an unbelievable amount of energy. Where did you get that? The volcanic cooling, that sounds good. The problem with that, though, is that typically these aerosols fall out of the atmosphere after a few years. And you need many years of this volcanic cooling in order for this to work. So you would need repeated volcanic eruptions. Okay, one set of eruptions isn't going to work. You need a bunch of eruptions spread out over some time. And that brings us to the final requirement that we need for an ice age, and that's time. And specifically, I'm not talking about just time in general. I mean a short time scale. Okay, a short time scale. And why do I mean that? The reason for this is that both secular scientists and creation scientists acknowledge that there was an enormous amount of volcanic activity in Earth history. Okay, a frightening amount. It was so much that it dwarfs anything that we can imagine. And they both agree that that can give you, if it's the right kinds of eruptions, it can give you volcanic cooling. So why can't secular scientists make better use of volcanic cooling to explain an ice age? Well, the reason's really simple. It's because they insist that those eruptions were separated by millions of years. And if you separate those volcanic eruptions by millions of years, the cooling effect is so diluted, it's not going to do anything. So you need those eruptions to be close together in time, within a short, relatively short time interval in order to make this work. So does the Bible give us some clues about what might cause an ice age? Well, it certainly does. And we think the Genesis flood is the key to solving this mystery. And we read in Genesis chapter 7, verse 11, that on that day, the day that the flood began, all the fountains of the great deep were broken up. And we think that's implying a large amount of volcanic and tectonic activity. In fact, most creation scientists think that plate tectonics played a big part in the flood. Now, when you hear evolutionists talk about plate tectonics, they're always talking about millions of years and continental drift. And we're saying, no, when you see these mid-ocean ridges here, those are actually scars from the Genesis flood. And we think that during the flood, the plates were moving very, very fast. And the slow movement of the plates that we have today, that's left over from the flood. In fact, one of the world's leading scientists in this field is Dr. John Baumgartner. He's a creation geophysicist, and he's done a tremendous amount of work, world-class work, modeling how catastrophic plate tectonics played a role in the flood. And that's why Dr. Vardaman was talking about the heat from the plates. Okay, because if you have catastrophic plate tectonics and the plates are moving very rapidly, that means new seafloor is being formed very rapidly. Today, new seafloor is being formed at the mid-ocean ridges, but it's very slow, very gradual. But if you had the plates moving really fast during the flood, you're going to have new seafloor being formed rapidly. And that new seafloor consists of hot magma. And when it comes in contact with the water, it's going to warm up the oceans, and it's going to be enough to significantly warm the oceans. So the flood, the volcanism, and the catastrophic tectonics with the flood is going to give you the warmer oceans. But can the flood also give you many years of volcanic activity? Well, yes, it can. Because you're going to have volcanic activity, and that volcanic activity is not going to come to a stop just because the flood ended. Okay, the earth is going to be reeling from this cataclysm for hundreds of years after the flood. And so you're going to have volcanic activity. We think there was a lot of volcanic activity toward the end of the flood, but also after the flood. Now, those volcanic eruptions are gradually decreasing in intensity, but you're going to have sporadic eruptions for hundreds of years after the flood, and those are going to put more aerosols back up in the atmosphere, and that's going to give you the cooler summers you need to get an ice age. So again, to remind you of these key points, the heat is really the key to explaining an ice age. The hot oceans would cause much more evaporation. That's going to put more moisture into the atmosphere, which gives you more snowfall. Aerosols from these volcanic eruptions are going to reflect sunlight, giving you cooler summers. And if that happens within a relatively short time, that's the key to explaining an ice age. So the Bible gives us a really good explanation for an ice age, and hopefully that little acrostic heat will help you remember the key points. The Bible also helps explain past climate change. Remember, we said that you're going to have more snowfall during the ice age, but you're also going to have a lot more rainfall. And we know that there are areas of the world that today are extremely dry, but they received much more rainfall in the relatively recent past. For instance, the Sahara, even the evolutionists admit, in the relatively recent past, it used to get abundant rainfall. It was lush. I mean, there was lush vegetation, there was abundant rainfall, and yet today the Sahara is bone dry. The American Southwest, today it's extremely dry, but during the Ice Age, there were lakes, big lakes. In fact, Lake Bonneville, the Great Salt Lake is actually the remnant of a much larger lake called Lake Bonneville. And so it's really not surprising you would have large standing bodies of water after the flood, and the intense rain during the Ice Age is going to keep those bodies of water filled for quite some time. They're not going to dry out for quite some time. Likewise, the Dead Sea region, according to Genesis, when Lot and Abraham separate, the Bible describes that region as a well-watered land. And the Bible has repeatedly describes the land of Canaan as a land flowing with milk and honey. And yet today, much of the Middle East is extremely dry, even that area. So we think this may help explain past climate change. Now, explaining why certain regions were getting more rainfall than others, that's a little bit harder to explain. But explaining why you were having a lot of rainfall during the Ice Age, that really does make sense in this model. And it may not be a coincidence that there are more references to snow, ice, and cold in the book of Job than in any other book of the Bible. We think Job's lifetime probably overlapped with that of the Ice Age. And there's all these references to snow and ice. From the chamber of the south comes the whirlwind, and cold from the scattering winds of the north. Have you entered the treasury of snow, or have you seen the treasury of hail, from whose womb comes the ice and the frost of heaven, who gives it birth? Now, again, the ice sheets did not come down to the Middle East, okay? So we don't think Job actually saw ice sheets coming down to where he was living. But it's quite possible the Middle East was getting more snowfall at that time. You know, later in the Bible, it's obvious that snowfall is a relatively rare occurrence, because it's mentioned as being exceptional. But during the Ice Age, that may not have been exceptional. And it's also possible that travelers from farther north may have told Job about these big ice sheets that they had seen farther north. So the Bible really helps explain past climate change, but it also explains the woolly mammoths. And the woolly mammoths, they're kind of cool. Not as cool as dinosaurs, but they're still pretty cool. But a lot of people, there are some big questions about the woolly mammoths. There's big mysteries about them. First of all, how did they live in Siberia during an ice age? There is good reason to believe that millions of woolly mammoths were living in Siberia during the ice age. The second question is, why did they become extinct? Now, why is it so hard to imagine woolly mammoths living in Siberia during the ice age? Well, it turns out that today, winters in Siberia are extremely cold. Winter lows can be typically minus 40 degrees Fahrenheit. And there have been occasionally, on some instances, the temperatures have actually gotten colder than the surface of Mars. It's just unbelievably cold in Siberia. To make it even worse, secular scientists think it was even colder during the Ice Age. There's a serious question as to whether mammoths could live in Siberia during the winter, even today, let alone during an ice age. How on earth could they have tolerated those kind of temperatures? And even if they could, where are they going to get food and water in sufficient quantities for them to thrive in Siberia? Well, again, this flood model helps answer that question, and it has to do with hot oceans. Basically, we think because the ocean water was so warm, there was no Arctic or Antarctic sea ice after the flood. Okay, the waters would have been warm. The world's oceans would have been warm. They would have been warm at all latitudes and at all depths because the water would have been thoroughly mixed. And this helps explain how woolly mammoths could live in Siberia. You see, if you don't have any ice, Arctic sea ice, and the ocean is warm, the Arctic Ocean is warm, guess what? That's going to help moderate the climate, much in the same way that Seattle, Washington has a temperate climate, even though it's farther north than New York City, because you have this warm, moist Pacific air that helps moderate the climate. And we think something very similar to that was going on in Siberia, because you had a warm, ice-free Arctic Ocean, and that moderated the climate. Now, it was still cold, but it was tolerable. The woolly mammoths could handle those. It wasn't as cold as it is today. Now, you may think again, well, that sounds fairly straightforward. So why can't secular scientists use a warm Arctic Ocean to explain how woolly mammoths lived on Siberia? Well, again, this is where their belief in millions of years is tripping them up, because they believe, based on their secular story, that Arctic sea ice was present at least 100,000 years ago. Well, the mammoths are thought to have gone extinct maybe 11,000 to 9,000 years ago. So presumably, you would have had woolly mammoths enduring thousands and thousands of years of unbelievably cold temperatures, because the Arctic sea ice was already there. It wasn't, the ocean was not warm. It wasn't moderating the climate. So their belief in millions of years, again, is tripping them up. So what happened to the woolly mammoths? Well, basically, ironically, we think that things got worse at the end of the ice age, because you had a lot of ice on land that melted. It flowed out onto the Arctic Ocean. That fresh water melted and froze, and you get this temperature difference between the lower and higher latitudes, and you get these big winds, and it's starting to dry out at the end of the ice age as well. And there were large dust storms, and a lot of these woolly mammoths, when you find their remains, they're in these frozen hills of windblown silt. And we think they were actually entombed, some of them actually buried alive during these giant dust storms. And basically, if you want to learn more about this, we have an article that kind of talks about this called "The Bible Best Explains the Ice Age." By the way, there's sort of an urban legend about the woolly mammoths that we kind of need to address. For a long time, it was popular, even among creationists, to say that there was this incredibly sudden and dramatic temperature drop, where the temperature dropped down to minus 150 degrees Fahrenheit. And the reason people said that was because, you know, you find vegetation in their stomachs. And so somehow that had to be preserved. And the thinking was that the only way that would work was if you had a really dramatic temperature drop. That's really hard to explain physically, and we don't really need it, because we now think that the reason that vegetation was preserved is because of the mammoth digestive system. Most of the digestion does not take place in the stomach. And they've actually found other mammoth remains that were not frozen, but still had some vegetation in the stomach. So you don't really need this temperature drop of -150 degrees Fahrenheit to explain the woolly mammoths. We think this model where the temperature did get colder, it became more severe, and a lot of them were entombed in these dust storms, but you don't need this fantastic temperature drop down to -150 degrees Fahrenheit. The Bible also helps us explain the Greenland and Antarctic ice sheets. Now, the reason I bring this up is because some secular scientists think that these ice sheets are an unanswerable argument for an old Earth, because scientists have drilled and extracted these cores from the ice, and they claim that they've counted, in the case of the Greenland ice cores, they've counted more than 100,000 annual layers. And at first glance, that seems to be an extremely strong argument for an old Earth. It turns out that argument is not nearly as strong as it first seems, because the most common way of dating the ice cores are theoretical age models. And guess what the secular age models assume? They assume that they assume millions of years. Okay, so it's hardly surprising that if you look at these Antarctic cores, they have ages of like 720,000, 400,000, 800,000 years assigned to the bottom of the ice cores. That's coming straight from their models. Their models assume millions of years. So the vast ages that they assign to Antarctic ice cores is almost, it's trivial. It's not a problem at all to explain. But what about the deep Greenland ice cores? At first glance, that looks like a stronger argument for an old Earth, because they claim that they could actually identify, count annual layers in the ice. Well, this is not nearly as simple as they think. The one core that some of the skeptics have focused on is called the GISP2 ice core. And they drilled down to 3,000 meters. And they think they thought they could only accurately date down to about 2,800 meters. And they assigned an age of 110,000 years to that depth. And so how did they do that? Well, they counted visible layers in the upper half of the core. But this is not nearly as easy as everybody thinks. A lot of people think, well, maybe you have a summer layer and a winter layer, that's a year. Summer layer, winter layer, that's a year. No, it turns out you actually have multiple layers per year, and the number of layers can vary from year to year. So they have to guess at how many layers should be grouped together and counted as a single year. It's not trivial. It gets harder as you go deeper into the ice. To give you a feel for how hard this is, scientists will sometimes dig these what they call snow pits, and they will actually look, and you can actually see layers in these snow pits, and they will dig them, and they will try to practice counting the layers. Well, I've seen a chart from the technical literature where they had a snow pit that had around 50 distinct layers that you could see. They had a diagram, and they assigned 9 years to that. Okay, so you had like 50 distinct bands that you could see, but they thought that it had been deposited over 9 years. That gives you a feel for kind of how hard this is. Now, in spite of that, though, you might be—I bet you would be surprised at what age they assigned halfway down the core. Does anybody want to guess what age they assigned? Now, remember, down here they're claiming the ice is 110,000 years old. Anybody want to take a stab at what age they assigned to a depth at 1,500 meters? Any takers? 50,000? Okay, that's a good guess. What else? Anybody want to go higher? 220? Anybody want to go lower? Okay. Well, guess what? They actually assigned an age of 9,300 years to that ice. Now, stop and think about that. That's 1.5 kilometers down. And you say, well, 9,300 years, that's still more than the Bible allows. Yes, that's true. But let's put this number in perspective. We think that the ice is ultimately from the post-flood ice age, and that the ice age, you know, let's just use round numbers. Let's say the flood ended 4,500 years ago. If the ice age lasted 700 years, that would make this ice about 3,800 years old. So stop and think about it. Okay, these two numbers are in the same ballpark. Okay, there's not that much difference between them. Yes, they're getting a bigger number. But remember, it is very, very, very hard to count those layers because you have to group them together and count and basically make an educated guess about how many layers should be grouped together and counted as 1 year. So it's remarkable that they're getting a fairly young number there. And that means that nearly all of the alleged time, 100,000 years worth, is coming from the bottom of the core. So what you really need to know, if you want to answer the answer these people when they say this is an argument for an old Earth, you really need to understand how they dated the bottom half of the core, because that's where all the alleged time supposedly is. And what they did was they counted dust peaks. You see, there's a seasonal range in dust, okay? You know, it can go up and then go back down. And sometimes you can see the dust. You can see cloudy bands in the ice where there's more dust. Sometimes you can't see it. Sometimes they have to use instruments to measure the dust. But they assume every time you see a peak, it represents spring, summer. Okay, that's a big assumption for a lot of reasons. One is we know that even individual snowstorms can cause the amount of dust to vary. And we think conservatively there would have been thousands of snowstorms during the Ice Age. So not only do you have this seasonal cycle, okay, you've got individual snowstorms that are complicating all this. The dust in the cores is very high. There's a lot of dust in the cores, and more importantly, it varies a lot. Okay, so this chart right here, this is actually the amount of dust from a Greenland ice core. And this right here is where the Ice Age ice stops, and the ice up here is after the Ice Age. Now, you see how little dust you have right here, but look what happens when you get to the Ice Age. All of a sudden, there's a lot of dust, and not only is there a lot of dust, it's jumping around. Okay, it's jumping around a lot. Now, why is that a problem? If you're trying to count dust peaks, why is that a problem? Well, hopefully this will kind of help you see what the issue is here. Now, this is not a trick question, but let me ask you, how many dust peaks do you see in this picture? So let's say we're looking at this section of a core, and we're trying to count dust peaks. How many dust peaks do you see right there? Okay, two, let's say two, okay? That one over here is kind of doubtful, okay? And it's not a trick question. Now, why did most of you think it was two? Okay, and the answer is kind of obvious. It's so obvious you don't even stop to think about it. One reason is because both peaks are approximately the same height, and also because you have a fairly well-defined background, okay? Okay, but let's suppose, though, that's not the case. Let's suppose the amount of dust is jumping around erratically in that ice core. Let's suppose instead of this, you see something like this. Do you see the problem now? Okay, where's the background? Okay, over here, it looks like the background might be here, or over here, maybe it's here or here. So is this right here an actual individual peak, or is it just a part of a larger overall peak? See, if you don't have a clearly defined background, this starts becoming a lot more complicated. And so that's the problem. The dust in that part of the ice core is jumping around all over the place, and so that makes it much harder to tell which of those peaks are truly seasonal. Furthermore, it depends on how close together you make your measurements. Okay, we saw, if you look at this right here, you see a number of peaks. But the person making those measurements did not make too many measurements, okay? How much you want to bet that if he had made more measurements, he would have seen even more spikes? And here's the reason for that. Let's suppose that you've got this section of an ice core, and let's suppose you make 5 dust measurements, okay? And you see, here's one amount of dust, here's dust here, here's dust here, here's dust here, here's dust here. Okay, you need about 4 or 5 measurements to see a peak. So if you only made 5 measurements, you would say there was one peak, right? But what if instead of making 5 measurements, you made 15 measurements, okay? Instead of seeing those red dots, you start seeing these black dots. How many peaks do you see now? At least 3, okay? Maybe 4 or 5, depending on whether or not you think these smaller ones are actually seasonal peaks. Okay, so that's part of the problem. The closer together you make your measurements, the more peaks you're going to see. And should I be counting a peak you know, if it's a small peak, do I count it as a seasonal change or not? And so that makes this much more complicated. By the way, secular scientists, their age models for the ice cores predict that the annual layers, if you could see them, get very thin at the bottom of the ice. And so they think that they need to make their measurements really close together. And so so they're just naturally going to count more peaks when they do this. And there's a funny story I can tell you about this. This actually happened. But then when they were first trying to date this ice core, they didn't get an age of 110,000 years for the bottom of the ice core. They got an age of 85,000 years. Now, turns out they didn't like that number because someone had already looked at another ice core from Antarctica. That core had been dated by the Milankovitch theory. And according to the Milankovitch theory, the ice at that depth was supposed to be 110,000 years old. So they didn't like that answer. They needed to find 25,000 more years down in the deep part of the ice. So guess what they did? They made the measurements a lot closer together. And sure enough, they found those extra 25,000 years. They were hiding in the ice, but they managed to find them. And so that shows you just how subjective this process is and that it's relatively easy to come up with even tens of thousands of additional quote-unquote years if you're looking for them. So you can basically find as many peaks in that dust as you want to. Now, so that we don't think these are convincing arguments for an old Earth. In fact, there's actually evidence that the ice sheets are young. And we actually did an article on this not too long ago that talks about some of the positive evidence that these ice sheets are young. We don't really have time to get into them right now, but we can maybe talk about it in the Q&A if you like. So if you'd like to learn more about this, we've got some resources dealing with the Ice Age. The Ice Age and the Flood booklet, it's a little technical, but if you want solid answers to why the ice cores do not prove millions of years, that's a good resource. And also the Ice Age, Real and Recent, that DVD, it's kind of similar to this talk. It shows how the Bible makes sense of the Ice Age, and also it really gets into a lot of the circular reasoning that secular scientists use when they're dating things. There's no strong evidence from the Antarctic cores, or even for the Greenland cores for millions of years. But you might wonder, well, can thick ice sheets form in just 4,500 years? And the answer is yes. Even the secular scientists acknowledge that you can get thick ice sheets to form in around 10,000 years, but that's assuming that the snowfall rates have always been as slow as they are today. And remember, we're arguing that during the Ice Age, you had much, much, much more snowfall. And so if you had a lot more snowfall, that's going to bring that number down to less than 4,500 years. And so you can get those thick ice sheets to form in that amount of time. And again, those are some resources we have on the topic. You might be wondering, if there was intense volcanic activity during the Ice Age, is it possible that maybe some evidence for that would show up in the ice cores? Sure enough, yes, it did. Okay, there's evidence of hundreds of large volcanic eruptions in the Ice Age portion of that Greenland ice core. I don't want to, they would say, I think, around 700. I don't want to focus too much on that number because I'm not sure how many old Earth assumptions may have come into that. But even the secular scientists think there were hundreds of big, big volcanic eruptions in the Ice Age portion of the ice. Now, if you believe that ice was deposited over 100,000 years, that's no big deal. But what if you have big explosive volcanic eruptions and that's occurring within, say, 700 years? Then you've got a really potent mechanism for explaining the Ice Age. So the uniformitarian explanations don't work. There was only one ice age, and it was recent. We think it started right after the flood, and the flood is the means for explaining that ice age. The Bible gives us the answer, and the Bible helps explain past climate change, the woolly mammoths, and why these Greenland and Antarctic ice sheets are not millions of years old like we're being told. So uniformitarians can't explain the ice age, and that's the most recent major geological event in Earth history. If they can't explain that, why on Earth would we accept these stories they're telling us about stuff that supposedly happened many millions and even billions of years ago? And what we see here is that the Bible's short time scale is the key to explaining Earth history. You know, a lot of Christians think that the Bible's short time scale is something that they should be embarrassed about. It's something for which they should sheepishly apologize. No. The Bible's short time scale is the key to solving these mysteries of Earth history that have puzzled these guys for literally hundreds of years. So it's the key. It's the Bible's short time scale is not the problem. It's the answer. And so again, if you'd like to learn more about this, we have these resources. We also have a booklet on climate change. And we talk a little bit more about that issue involving the supposed evidence for the Milankovitch theory. And there's all kind of neat stuff in there we could tell you about. I think we've almost sold out of the book, The Young Earth, but that's a great resource as well. My dad's not a scientist, but he said he could follow the arguments in the book. It was really a good resource. I think we've sold out of these, Guide to Creation Basics and Creation Basics and Beyond. But again, if we ran out of a resource that you want, please go back to that table. Get a card from Joel, and there's a little code that you can use so that you can still get a discount on that resource online. We've also got our magazine, Acts and Facts. Again, please, if you haven't signed up for it now, please do so. We hope it'll be a blessing to you. And again, we've got this Discovery Center. And if you ever come down to the Dallas area, we hope you'll give us a visit. And I want to show you one last time that little promo for the Discovery Center. Yeah, my heart soars whenever I see that video. Okay, so that's really all I have for the Ice Age, and I think we'll still have a Q&A a little bit later. So stick around if you like. Feel free to hit me with your best shot, and I'll do my best to answer those questions as best I can. Thank you. All right.